Thank you very much. So I'm very excited to talk about Assassin today. And what I hope you get from this talk is not just an overview of what Assassin is, that Assassin is an extremely useful tool to find the closest and the brightest supernovae to us. But I hope you also get out of this talk that Assassin is useful for a number of other areas of astrophysics as well, and generally in transient astronomy. So the first thing that I want to mention, like I do in pretty much all my talks, is that the sky is big. So I want you to keep this in your mind, not just for this talk, but for any all-sky survey talk that you hear. If you want to put a single pixel on every square second of the sky, you're dealing with about a terabyte of data for every image of the sky that you want to take. And of course, in transient searches, you want to have as fast a cadence as possible, and this is a very large data rate that you have to deal with. So it's just something to keep in the back of your mind during this talk and other talks that you may listen to in the future. But the sky isn't just big. If it was just big, it'd be pretty boring. The sky's alive, it's vibrant, it's variable. Sometimes it's even violent. There are many different astronomical phenomena on different scales, all of which vary on the sky, all the way from our own solar system to explosions after the first stars form. And in fact, if you look at almost any object close enough, you'll see that it varies, as we have some of the world's experts in astroseismology in the room currently. But Assassin is targeted to study all these phenomena. But for any survey, especially one that is manpower limited as Assassin is, you really have to focus on what your core goal is and how you measure your success as a survey. And for Assassin, these are those goals. Basically, we want to monitor the entire sky every few nights in real time down to a V-band limiting magnitude of about 17. To do this, we use telephoto lenses and CCD and commercially available CCDs. We do this for two reasons. One is it makes us relatively less expensive, and the other reason is it allows us to quickly expand when more funds become available, as I'll talk about in the future, because we can basically just place orders with commercial entities and expand in months rather than years. And finally, the real heart of the science goal of Assassin is to find nearby supernovae in a minimally biased sample as possible. We want to find all the nearby supernovae, no matter where they go off. They go off in big galaxies or small galaxies. We want to find them all. And I hope to show you in this bottom plot right here that we're doing pretty well. So this is all the supernovae discovered from April of last year to December that are brighter than 17th magnitude. On the x-axis, I show the host galaxy luminosity, so big galaxies on the right, small galaxies on the left. On the y-axis, I show the offset from the center of the galaxy that the supernova was discovered at. So this is 1 arcsecond right here and 100 arcseconds, so quite far out. And in this plot, all the blue squares are the supernovae discovered by all amateurs combined. The red circles are just Assassin, and the black triangles are all other professional surveys combined. So I hope you'd get three things from this plot. One, Assassin does quite well. There's a lot of red on this plot. The second one is that Assassin finds supernovae in small galaxies and places where other surveys just aren't finding them. This is due to our all-sky approach. And the third thing, which is possibly the most surprising about Assassin, is that we find supernovae very close into the cores of galaxies. So if you just take the median of all these different samples, these are those dotted lines. So the amateurs and professionals are about finding supernovae about a factor of two farther out from the cores as Assassin. And it's not that Assassin's missing these. We're just not the first ones to discover these. The vast majority of the other supernovae were just not the discoverers. But they are easily detected in the Assassin data. But this sample right here, the sample that's very close in near the cores of galaxies where it's hard to find variable objects, Assassin is doing extremely well in.
So are you actually just, because you're focused on the supernova, reporting them more than the sort of integral of all those black points? Because I think another surprising thing is that few supernova are being reported by things like,
I would imagine
PTF would have tons of supernova, but they're not.
So PTF has a significantly slower cadence than we do, and surveys like LOSS and PTF have changed their focus in recent times, and basically they want a higher cadence because they want to catch things extremely early, so which means they can do less sky. So I would say I don't know the inner workings of either one of these, but if you find a bright supernova, you generally report it as soon as possible because now it's known that other groups will find it. But I don't know the inner workings of these other groups. I mean, I don't know. Can you comment on PTF? Yeah.
Well, yes. I was curious to see if you have a volume comparison later because BTS is indeed doing high cadence now, so usually once per night, several times per night, it's repeating the same field. So that does reduce the effective area of it per night, but it still goes four magnitudes deeper.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also an untargeted survey, so it also specializes in faint galaxies. It does not pick the galaxies in that.
So it should be emphasized that Assassin does not find more supernovae than BTS. This is limiting the sample to where Assassin does well, which is the bright things, and that was the design of Assassin. But definitely PTF finds many more supernovae than Assassin does. But their volume is deeper rather than shallow like Assassin.
Okay. Why do you find it closer?
I hope to. This is basically motivation for you to listen to the rest of the talk, and I'll mention this a couple times. But it generally has to do with that our images subtract extremely cleanly, and this allows us to probe into inner regions. And if you saturate in the core of a galaxy with a big telescope, you're not going to find a supernova there. So this is possibly another advantage of Assassin, just that we're small. So nearby bright galaxies like M31, for example. We only saturate in the very core of M31, but all other galaxies we basically don't saturate on.
How long has Assassin been going for?
So there's a number of different stages. We first started taking data, 2.5 years ago. But the lead up to the and development of the pipeline took a long time. I'll talk more about that again later in the talk. To get to this stage, we deployed our southern unit actually almost exactly a year ago now. So most of the things that I'll talk about as far as rates of supernovae are since last April going forward. And that's when we deployed our southern unit and we really became full sky and when our pipeline started to go real time.
But you would have seen like 2011 FE. If you were online at
that time? We would have seen it, but PTF, I'm pretty sure, I don't know the exact magnitude that PTF found 11FE yet, but I'm pretty sure PTF would have beat us to it, because they found it extremely early.
Right.
Yeah, it was quite faint. But 14J, actually, the reason we didn't discover 14J is because we just expanded our northern unit to have four cameras. And there was just a pointing error in the telescope, so we couldn't point above 60 degrees declination for about 2 weeks. And that's right when it went off at 68 degrees.
It was full moon anyway, so probably...
Well, we wouldn't have caught it super early, but I mean, we definitely would have caught it before it was announced. We cannot discover them when they're 19th magnitude, that's correct, yeah. We wouldn't have been the first one to discover 11FE. So I would say we have found one supernova extremely early, which I'll talk about later in the talk, but that is not the main focus of Assassin. The main focus, there are other groups which can do much better at this. The main focus of Assassin is to really get an unbiased sample, and so you know you get every nearby one, so you can study host galaxy properties. You can actually, we have a proposal in now for MUSE on VLT to actually study the entire host galaxy in detail, and you can actually pinpoint the supernova went off here, what's special about that location. You can start to study the places inside galaxies that supernova go off with a huge sample of hundreds of supernovae in the next couple of years. So that's the real focus of Assassin as far as supernovae. And then periodically we catch things pretty early, but we're not going to catch things hours after explosion.
Just wanted to add that indeed quite impressive that you find things so close to the centers of galaxies, especially because the pixels are quite big, right?
Yeah.
How big can you find them?
So the pixels are 7.8 arc seconds on a side.
Right. And you're doing like sub-arcs, so I think that's
yeah, our pixels are this big.
Yeah, okay. So that's a very impressive human surprising software.
Yeah, so I would say this is probably one of the most surprising things of Assassin so far, is just how well we do in the very cores of galaxies and in crowded regions as well.
And is that just luck, or is there some trickery?
So there's some trickery. So Kachanik is extremely good at image subtraction. He's the one who's done that portion of the pipeline. So that's some of it. And then...
Okay.
So another thing, but... Kachanik does a lot, but he can't do miracles. I would say another thing that Assassin benefits from is that we do so well because we do so poorly. Because seeing doesn't matter for us, like our focus is pretty stable, and the lenses that we have an extremely stable PSF across the field of view. So unlike some planet surveys which use lenses and have a wider field of view where they have very bad PSF distortions throughout their image, we don't have any of these problems. And so I think all of these things combined lead to us being able to do well in the various centers of galaxies and in other crowded regions. Sweet, slide three. okay, so this is supposed to be just motivation for my whole talk to keep guys engaged. First, I'm gonna just talk and introduce you to Assassin, what Assassin is, and give you some tell you who we are and what it is. Then I'm gonna talk about a few interesting discoveries that we've discovered so far. Then I'm gonna go on to our Assassin patrols, and these are our data release strategy. And basically, we want to release our data in useful ways and underline useful in boldface and emphasize useful. And finally, I'll tell about some of the future directions which we see Assassin going in. So the first thing to realize is that Assassin really is a global partnership. We have partners in six countries on five different continents. There's a few individuals that I'd like to mention specifically, and these are the individuals who work on Assassin, either the pipeline or the follow-up on a daily basis. There's myself, there's Chris Kachanik, the two of us have basically written the entire pipeline. Chris Stanek is involved in basically almost every aspect of Assassin. Tom Holoyne and Bianca Danilette are two second-year grad students at OSU. They're both extremely good. Tom is working on portions of the pipeline with me and writing papers on a number of interesting Assassin results, and you'll see some of his work in this talk. And Bianca Danilette just started working with us a little bit ago, and she's working with me on the CV patrols and the Assassin patrols to release our data to the public. And then two others that I want to mention are Jose Prieto and Super Dong, and they're the ones who are really leading the effort of organizing our follow-up, the follow-up data that we obtain on the particularly interesting Assassin sources. So if you want to break it down by institution, Ohio State is really the home base. It's where all the scheduling and data reduction is done. It's where all the data is analyzed. Los Alamos and the University of Warsaw aided in the pipeline development. Our funding has come from both federal sources, the NSF, institutional sources like CCAP, the Center for Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics, and interestingly, amateur foundations such as the Mount Cuba Astronomical Foundation, who are supplying the funds to actually to complete our southern unit. You look like you have a question.
I'm just kind of amazed that you're getting money from the amateurs. That seems like, wow.
Not like joke. Like I guess they provided a little over $100,000, so not a small amount of money either. Assassin is really trying to reach out to the amateur community in many different ways, and you'll see some of that in this talk as well. I should definitely absolutely mention LCOGT, not because just because they're here, but they're also a huge portion of Assassin. They supply our site support and our mounts, and I'll talk about them in the next few slides. And then finally, our follow-up comes from many different institutions at this point, and I show some of their logos down here. So LCOGT is a global telescope network of 2, 1, and 0.4 meter class telescopes. Actually, I realized that on this plot, I'm missing China now, which was added. But the two sites which are important for Assassin are Haleakala, Hawaii, and Cerro Tololo, Chile. So in Hawaii, our northern unit is on Maui, it's on Haleakala, and on the top of this mountain, we share the dome with the Fulk's Telescope North 2 meter. The Fulk's Telescope North is seen here. The original ACES survey, where we get our namesake from, is in the foreground, Assassin's in the background. And this isn't a clamshell dome, so when it opens to the sky, we actually have full access, and so actually there is Assassin right there. This is an overview of our northern unit, Brutus. So it's four telescopes, it's four telephoto lenses on a common mount, backed by a 2K by 2K CCD, thermoelectrically cooled from Finger Lakes instruments. This setup gives us a 4.5-degree field of view per camera. Our pixel scale is almost 8 arcseconds per pixel. We run V-band filters. And what's impressive is that this one unit can survey about 10,000 square degrees in a single night.
So what's in it for LCOGT? How come you guys provided these mounts? That seems like very...
So my understanding is that in the early days, this mount was developed as a prototype with 1-meter mounts. and Wayne wanted to have an opportunity to debug the software that controls it and so on. And so that's how the deal came to be made with Assassin.
So we went through, so this is one of the growing pains that we went through was just actually debugging the software that went into controlling the mounts. So this is, I mean, without the mount, we wouldn't have anything at all. So, but this is one of the processes.
Like, are those mounts and software still in use then?
Yes, so now we're using those mounts for the 40 centimeter telescopes. We have one deployed and six more coming this year and probably another eight more after that.
So that seems like
worked
out really nicely.
We think so. So this is our northern unit. And this is just an example of one image of M33 taken with Brutus. This is M33. And just to give you a scale of just how large this field of view really is. So the reason we have four cameras is to increase our sky coverage. We have some overlap between them, about a half a degree. So some areas of the sky get a higher cadence imaging, where these fields butt up against adjacent fields. This just gives you a sense of just how big we're really talking about when we talk about these images.
But do you dither it, or do you actually have stripes that are super deep?
Plots are coming up, but we do take two, at every pointing, we take two images, and then we dither between them to get rid of false positives. So our southern unit is in one of the LCOGT Agwon structures. This is actually 0.4 meter in the foreground, but if we flip around and look at the other side of the structure, then you can see our southern unit, which is the same as our northern unit, except Cassius only has two lenses right now, but in the next couple months that will be expanded to have four lenses as well. So then the southern unit can only do 5,000 square degrees per night, but it will again do 10,000 square degrees per night like Brutus.
So you're doubling the camera to 10,000
a month? In a month or two, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so we already have the funds. We're actually waiting currently for the CCDs to be, from Finger Lakes Instruments to be well manufactured.
But you're using the same telescope infrastructure and everything, so you're not just doubling, you're just increasing the field of view of the cameras.
That's correct. So we're basically just putting two more cameras on the same mount. So the supports for the cameras can hold four just like the northern unit can. This is our cadence as of this morning. The purple is basically what was taken last night. Green is basically 2 days ago. And so what you can see on this is that our coverage on the sky is basically every 2 to 3 days. We do avoid the full moon. We do the entire northern sky, but we do avoid the southern galactic plane at this point until we expand. Once we have the other cameras, then we'll start to do the entire sky. And at that point, we'll be the first, at least to my knowledge, the first survey in human history to survey the entire sky in real time. And I say that to my knowledge because maybe there's some military instruments. So this gives you an idea of our sky coverage. And then from a talk I had with John yesterday about Assassin, I decided to make this plot. And this is basically the number of times a particular part of the sky has been observed in the past 360 days, or basically a year. And what you can see is that we have basically 160 images of most of the sky. And we just started doing the northern galactic plane a couple months ago, so we have fewer images of that location.
Right, but what's your depth at 400 observations? Like, well, the dark purple, those must be pretty deep little spots.
So this is a good observation. So we basically try to have a uniform sky coverage as possible, except we do focus on a couple things. So this is probably the LMC. And so we do focus on the LMC, SMC, M31, and M33. But other than that, we have no special priority. And basically, this wasn't done for depth, although it might be useful for some work that we may do with John. But this is done just to have a higher cadence. So basically, if something goes off in the LMC, say Ogle has bad weather, we are in almost the same spot as Ogle. But if Ogle's down for some reason, we really want to make sure that we find whatever varies quickly on these interesting targets.
But it's still the same. I mean, your exposure time is fixed per exposure, right? So it is really the integral or not?
It is the integral. So basically, our exposure time is basically fixed. We do also do shorter exposure times on a select number of fields. And we would like to do that over the entire sky, because then we could go from basically naked eye down to 17th magnitude. But now we don't have the resources to double our data rate. But all of this is the same exposure time. Great. This is just a schematic of our pipeline. I don't want to walk through everything with you because I don't want to bore you to death. But there's two things that I want to bring to your attention. The first thing is that there are two ways that Assassin makes our data public. The first one is through our transient source detection pipeline. That's what I'll talk about in the next couple of slides. And this is basically finding new sources, but it does take human intervention. And then we announce those either through our website or our more interesting sources we announce via ATELS. And then the second one, which is fully automated, there's no humans whatsoever, but it's looking at known objects that are doing interesting things. And this is the Assassin patrols. And those I'll talk about at the end of the talk.
Known variables
or just all? So basically, we're looking at CVs. We've already started with CVs. We want to move on to AGN, blazars, quasars, M-dwarfs. And then basically, we're open to suggestions to create other focused efforts. So the first thing, if you want to understand our transit pipeline, that you have to at least have an intuitive grasp of is image subtraction. So this is your 45-second introduction to image subtraction. So the first thing you do is you take all of your images, you take your best images, and you stack them to make a very deep reference image at a particular location. You obtain a new image at that same location, which will come up now. And then you have to interpolate that so it matches the exact location of your reference. And then you convolve and subtract. And so basically, anything that's constant just completely goes away. This is actual data from Assassin of the LMC. You see the LMC disappears. There is some noise, of course. If there's more flux in a region, you have more noise in the subtracted image. But then the game on our transient source detection pipeline is that you have to find new sources in these subtracted images. So something that changed in brightness will be black in these subtracted images, and you want to find those and throw out all the false positives. So the quick rundown of our pipeline is we first subtract, then we use sextract to define new sources. This is overwhelmingly dominated by false positives. Then we have to make many cuts to find real sources, such as flux and this noise. How point-like is this source? The dithers help cut a lot out. And we started recently using machine learning as well in our data. On the bottom here, so once we go through all those cuts, then it's put to one of our scanners. And this is exactly what our scanner would see on the bottom here. So the upper left-hand corner, this is the reference image at this location. As you go, start from the bottom right and go left, and then up. This is stepping through time at this location. The top row, the center two, these are our two dithered images. And the right is a co-ad of those two dithered images. And so what you can see at this particular source is there's nothing at this location, nothing at this location, and then all of a sudden, there's this very obvious source. And this is a 16th magnitude asteroid, which is detected quite cleanly. And generally, our scanners wouldn't actually look at an asteroid because all the asteroids that Assassin sees are already known. But we reverse the problem, and it's the asteroids that we allow us to really make our cuts quite strong. So if you start losing asteroids that you know you should be getting, then you know that your cuts have become too strong, so you have to back off. And so this is how we went through and basically taught our pipeline how to find real sources.
Scanners are people, yes?
People, real people.
On a given night, how many potential transits are you looking at?
So at this stage, before we make cuts, there's tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands, depending if it's full moon or not, false positives. And then now we've got it down to our scanners just have to look at a couple hundred per day. And a large fraction of these are real. There's a lot of CVs. There's a lot of known CVs that vary. So a lot of the things that our scanners have to look through are just real transient events. So usually, most of this is done by Stanek, Jose Prieto, and then Subo Dong. But most is
That's
done
like
by
10 real people.
Yeah. So I actually do almost no scanning whatsoever. But they every day there's hundreds of images that they go through.
Can we just, because we have the expertise in the room, like, can we get a comparison of what for example, like the marshal would do, or, you know, in a certain circumstance or whatever, for like LCO, you know, alerting, because it's a, I think this is a, just a bigger problem for the broader community to be aware of, and I feel like it's an art that is buried in a lot of these pipelines and stuff that's not often brought to the fore. But, you know, when you think about this terabyte per image and like sort of an LSST world, you know, I don't think that the community is generally prepared for this. And that's kind of a trite statement, but can you guys maybe comment on just comparing that false positive rate and how it's handled in different surveys right now?
So in PTF, it is also true that almost all news sources are noise. And it also goes through many cuts, including machine learning. And it's eventually about 100 or 150 candidates per night that a person goes over. I guess one of the bigger differences is that PTF observes every field twice a night, separated by half an hour at least. And so that rules out most at least rapidly moving asteroids. Also, since we're in the north, I think we have larger overlap with SDSS, so we can actually rule out things that are not stars if we're not interested in variable stars. And then the other major difference is that the people in PDF are looking at this during the night. So we have people in Israel and Sweden who are the scanners for PDF. So it's their daytime when PDF is observing.
How many scanners does PDF have?
So I think it's around 10 or 15 people.
Okay.
So each one has to do it once every 2 weeks. So it's probably easier than for you guys. Yeah, but it's an order of 100 candidates a night, but they are required to do it in real time, because if they find something, we want to get the same night classification and follow up whenever possible. That's what PTF is focusing on.
And so GT is not doing search, he's doing follow-up.
Right,
so
right, so it's not the same.
It's not the same, but there are other surveys that have the same problem. I think also LaCiaquest, all the big surveys have, most of them have someone looking at the data and try to...
Right, I mean, so the machine learning and like all of these tricks sort of get you down to some number of targets for like these surveys that are kind of, these homegrown surveys that are currently going on, which, you know, but in the sort of, even in the next generation surveys, it seems like that's...
Well, you can look at it both ways. You set your, I mean, the machine learning thing just give you an ordered list.
Yeah.
And you just put your cut wherever you think. We just decided 100, 150 is what, you know, no
you
one should look at more than that every night. Because eventually, even if you have a real supernova, after 100 candidates, you won't notice it. So we chose the cut so that we get 100 candidates.
Okay.
That's similar to Assassin too. Basically, we make many cuts before the scanners even go, but then actually the scanners then on the website, which I didn't have right here, is basically a bunch of other selections that they can tweak, and so they can search like just the highest priority ones. If you wanted to look through 20 to find something super bright, then you could, but it's also ordered. So LSST, I have no idea what you're gonna do.
But I think that most roughly speaking, I think all these big surveys, the under that they're looking are 99% all real candidates. I mean,
right.
Most of them. And so I think the main problem is then the follow-up. Since it's missing the follow-up to follow all these transients, I think the role of the scanner is also to select the best one and decide on which one to follow later. And so
right.
I think the problem is more there. Than,
Especially for the deeper ones. So for Assassin, basically anything that we find is relatively interesting because it's so bright, so we do better here. And with this overlap with SDSS, you basically already have your source. So if you see a real variable object that looks real, or a transient object, if it overlaps with SDSS, you either see the source, and if you don't see the source, it's extremely interesting because it just varied by by more than 7 magnitudes, at least. So Assassin avoids many of these more challenging problems because we only go so bright. So we're basically trying to skim the cream off the top. No, we've so I have a couple slides. We're
compiling your list as you go along.
Yeah, so we've discovered more than 300 new CVs on the sky. So we're compiling like variable objects. That's another whole branch of Assassin that we want to do with Assassin data. They'll talk briefly about in this one, but not much more. Sweet. So we're not quite as real time as we just heard PTF scanning real time, but generally we do announce our targets within hours, having both Chris in Ohio, Jose in Chile, and then Subo Dong in China allows us to scan most of our data quite quickly. So we typically announce things that we're sure of in hours. Soon, one of the things that we want to start to do is going a little bit deeper and looking for slower timescale transients by stacking multiple nice images and then scanning on that as well.
Where's the actual image subtraction happening? Is that at Ohio State?
It's in Ohio State, yeah. So right now, all of our servers are at Ohio State, and I'm about to get one in Carnegie. But the one in Carnegie will basically be used to run the patrols to release data to the public.
How long does it take to subtract the whole night's
work? So it's being subtracted completely in real time. So each image takes about, from the time it's taken to the time it's subtracted, is less than 20 minutes, generally speaking. On the patrols, then we do photometry in known sources, and now it's like 30 minutes after the data is taken. It'll be announced if something changed fully automatically without any human intervention.
Since you're seeing, or your pixels are about 8 arc seconds across, what is your PSF size? Is it smaller than the pixel or is it larger than the pixel?
So it's larger than the pixel. It's about 1. Well, we have two different cameras that are in use. One's 1.8 and the other one's 2.2 pixels. So I just give you an example of an asteroid, but this is a very apt example of Assassin. So this is a real supernova that we found, Assassin 15BO, not very long ago. This is our first image, our first detection, at about 17.1 magnitudes. So if you look through, you can see that there's nothing at the source, and then maybe you can squint at this location that you may see it. You can also see that the sky is getting brighter because you can just look at the average noise and it gets higher. At this point, we basically say, oh, it looks interesting. We probably wanted to flag this before machine learning, but machine learning said that this looked like a real source, so we decided to get another, to put it into our queue to force it to get another observation the next night.
Machine learning said, right, there's some feature that it
there's
was
some feature, but
you don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is. I mean, your eye doesn't pick it out, right? Like, it's obviously in this image, well, more in this image, but in this image, it's just very difficult to see almost
anything. The machine doesn't know anything that isn't in your combined consciousness, right? So we must be something.
Well, it's looked at more images than I have, right? Like, it's looked at all of our asteroids and other real sources that we've gone through. Like, it's looked at all of these and figured out things which my eye has not figured out. Maybe Stanek's eye would be better at this because he's looked at more, but this would be a difficult call for me. I would probably flag this to be observed the next night, which is exactly what he did. So when you observe it the next night, it looks much realer in this much more real in this image. And at this point, we then ask for a high resolution follow-up image. This is the image right here on the right-hand side. So right on the right-hand side, an archival SDSS GMAN image is on the left-hand side. And so you can see, yes, there's definitely more flux at this location. So at this point, we announce an ATEL immediately. But this is a great example of Assassin because look at the scale of this galaxy. This is a teeny galaxy. If you were doing galaxy targeting surveys, you would never pick this out. There's no redshift even in NED, but it's quite close given the supernova spectrum. It's only at 0.03. So this is a prime example of why this is a prime example of a target which Assassin was designed to find. The reason this is a really good example of Assassin is it shows that a recent strategy that we started to implement. And if you look at the first four authors on the ATEL, these are all actual amateur astronomers. So basically how we get follow-up extremely quickly is that we sent out an email to all of the successful supernova hunters. And we said, you guys search through 10 to 20,000 images per night to find a single supernova. How about looking through 20? And most of them wrote back and said positive. And so the deal is that as soon as we have a candidate that we follow up, we dig quite far into the noise. So we'll go for a completion rate of about 5%. They get an image back to us, and the first one to get an image back to us is first author, second author, so on. And so this, before we even wrote the ATEL, we had four images. All of our targets have gotten an image no later than a day later. Most of our targets get an image back in less than an hour. Because we have amateurs on almost every continent, some of our amateurs have I think Joe has six almost half meter telescopes on four continents. So they're quite, I mean, calling them amateur is a little bit of an understatement. But this goes well because we don't use these images for photometry. We don't need good flat fields. We don't need science grade data. All we need is a higher resolution image than Assassin, which is easy to get because Assassin has huge pixels. So this has worked out quite well, and this is one of the reasons why we're starting to get some funding for amateurs, because anything that we find, they can follow up and have fun with. So this was a brilliant idea from Chris Stanek to do this, and it allowed us to actually further increase our discovery rate just by digging so much harder into the noise than we otherwise would have. This is just the SDSF's archival images of the location of our supernovae, of 30 of our 1As. To be on this plot, you had to have both SDSS imaging and two mass magnitudes. And so it's roughly sorted by size of the galaxy, actually infrared absolute magnitude. From the lower right-hand side, it's more massive, and then as you go up, it's less massive. And what you just get from this plot is what you've seen in other plots, but this is a better image, is that Assassin finds supernovae in many different environments, from the very cores of galaxies all the way to the outskirts of very small galaxies. And if you just want to look at just numbers, I showed you the plot in the third slide, but this is actual binning. If you look from May of last year to November, these are the number of supernovae discovered that were brighter than the 17th magnitude on the sky. You see that Assassin is doing quite well. And then if you look at from December to yesterday, Assassin, I think I can say, is dominating the local discovery rate just by number, where we're discovering more nearby supernovae than all of the groups combined.
These are public alerts, right?
These are all public. So anything that Assassin finds that we think is at all interesting, we either make it an ATEL right away or we put it on our website. So everything, this is an overarching theme in Assassin, is to make all of our transients and interesting discoveries public as soon as possible so that anybody can follow them up.
So since you guys are able to probe into kind of the centers of galaxies in a way that maybe other surveys aren't doing, are you able to look at the radial profile sort of on average of your supernovae and compare that with the radial profiles of star formation to actually get some hints about the progenitors?
Several people have done that.
Yeah.
I think more important than going really close to the center is just having large numbers. There is a lot of work, and it's true that for whatever mysterious reason that Assassin is really good at finding things in the center. Right. It is completing that picture that other surveys are probably missing a lot of supernovae there, or yes.
Yeah, it just seems, I mean, your mass-weighted star formation, right, is peaked. And so, you know, it's one thing to say that, well, we're, you know, not sensitive because of, you know, image detraction. But if you guys are sensitive, then it does it out. Do the number, does the story sort of hang together about different, you know, consistent with, I guess, what previous authors have found about it tracing star formation?
I think it's still relatively small numbers, right?
But especially for a core collapse, we have small numbers. Almost all of these are 1As. So there you expect it to roughly trace, well, some to trace star formation, but not nearly as strongly as core collapse, obviously.
But you still have population, right?
Yeah.
One striking thing that they are finding a lot of, even with small numbers, I don't know if you're going to talk about tidal disruption.
Yeah, I'm going to mention them.
Okay.
So yeah, expert in TDEs. So hopefully I don't say anything, correct me if I say anything stupid when I get to that part of my talk. Yes. All right, so... so this is pure numbers of supernovae. So now I'm going to change gears. If there's no more questions on samples of supernovae, I'm going to start to talk about individual interesting discoveries that Assassin's made, and I'll probably have to skip a few of them because I think otherwise I'm going to run over time. Yes. All right. So Assassin has discovered, as of last night, 131 nearby supernovae. We have over 150 ATELs in the past 2 years. We have six direct publications, five more in preparation from core team members, but there are many other publications that are being written using Assassin data. I already mentioned that we've discovered more than 300 new supernovae, mention CVs. I'll mention one particular supernova, which I'm working on right now, which is 14LP. This is the second brightest supernova discovered of last year, second only to 2014J, which was discovered in M82. And 14J is actually a very unique supernova because it's the closest supernova in the past 40 years. So 14LP is quite close. And on the right-hand side here, I just show a plot I actually made this morning using the ASSASSIN data, which is shown in green. The discovery image is right here. And then CSP, Carnegie Supernova Project follow-up, just R-band here. And then the game that's usually played is when you want to look for when your explosion time was. You just fit a power law to your light curves. I fit them independently for these two. And you can see that ASSASSIN actually discovered the supernova a little bit under 2 days after explosion. So this is quite early. This isn't at all the record holder. Actually discovering it here would have been very difficult. But we do have another marginal detection a little bit less than a day before this point from our other unit, from our southern unit. This is data from our northern unit. And there's also amateur data that I'm analyzing that probes earlier times as well. So then this is interesting because we also have near-infrared spectroscopic follow-up, optical spectroscopic follow-up, and a lot of other data on this this event. And you can use the early time parts of the light curve to probe progenitor models. We've also discovered an interesting young stellar object. I'll kind of zoom through this, the next two to save time. But in 2013, we saw a 4-magnitude outburst from a Titori star. Our first spectrum looked like it was just noise, but if you actually look closely at it, it's actually just a forest of iron lines. This is an interesting young stellar object, which is accreting material, but it holds off in its quiescent phase, and then all of a sudden it accretes a huge amount of material, and you get a forest of mostly iron lines out of it. What's particularly interesting for this source, this is from our public website, our CV patrol, is that this is the first outburst right here, and then actually very recently, for the past 150 days, it's in an even more luminous state, and events like this, these XOR events, are not supposed to have two large outbursts nearby. We just got ALMA data in December, but we haven't actually received the data yet. The data was taken. We didn't receive the analyzed data yet. And so this is an interesting source, which has a story which is continuing to unfold. I'll mostly skip through this, except for saying that ASSASSIN is also very good at discovering large M-dwarf flares. We've discovered two of the largest M-dwarf flares ever detected. And on the right-hand side here, I show you a 9-magnitude flare. This is actually our two dithered images in ASSASSIN. We got the data, analyzed it, our scanner realized that this was an interesting source, and we put it back into our queue on our northern unit, and we actually got another ASSASSIN data point in the same night, just a little over 2 hours later. So this shows you the fast turnaround that ASSASSIN can do. We don't guarantee this performance on every event, but often we can do this. I'll skip this. And then finally, I'll focus on two interesting things that ASSASSIN has shown to be good at because it can do so well in the centers of galaxies. And these are probably the two biggest surprises to come from ASSASSIN so far that were unexpected. So the first one are TDEs. So what is a TDE? It's a tidal disruption event. So there are many stars in the center of our own galaxy. If you look in the infrared, very close. I'm sure all of you have seen this movie, but I can stare at this movie forever because I love this movie. You actually trace near massive stars in the very center of our galaxy orbiting the supermassive black hole. But what happens if one of these orbits is perturbed and sent too close to the black hole? This is a simulation. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, there's a black hole and a star that gets too close. When it gets too close, it gets ripped apart. Half the material becomes unbound from the star, and the rest of the material is put into a very really thin stream that comes up, that is then confined to basically a plane. Not very much would happen at this point, except for GR precession. So as the stream approaches the black hole, I don't know why the video's not starting. As it approaches the black hole, it's actually bent and out of an elliptical orbit, and so it can actually collide and interact with itself, and then form an accretion disk around the black hole. What's interesting is ASSASSIN has actually been able to find two TDE candidates, where previously in the optical only about 10 have been discovered. I say the twiddle is there not because I can't count the literature, but because there are candidates which I think are uncertain. that are published in the literature. But the two TDEs that Assassin have found are or will be the best and brightest, best studied TDE candidates. Because they're so bright, we have a huge amount of follow-up all the way from the x-rays down to the near IR. And it appears that Assassin might be finding more supernovae more TDEs than previous groups in their previous rate estimates. But this definitely needs to be better quantified and will be in a paper that will come out in a couple months by Tom Holoyne. It's tantalizing because, as we saw, for supernovae, we do better in the centers of galaxies, so it's easy to imagine this. And this brings you closer to the theoretical rate of TDEs. But the common question of this, and I'm sure you're all too polite to ask, is that so you see a brightening in the very well associated with the center of a galaxy. How do you know it's a TDE? How do you know it's not something more more common like an AGN flare or a quark collapse supernova? Because we know the star formation of the center of galaxies. So how do you know it's not just a quark collapse supernova? And I'll argue against both of those individually. The first one that is typically taken as evidence against AGN activity is basically that the host galaxy shown in black in this is the spectral evolution of 14AE, or first TDE, basically shows no narrow line emission whatsoever, which is the hallmark of Seyfert-1s and Seyfert-2s. So there is no narrow line emission in the host galaxy, which would say that this would have to be some very weird type of AGN accretion to form this event. This is just host galaxy subtracted, so you can see that the TDE, this particular one, has extremely broad H-alpha and higher order Bollmuch series lines and very little helium emission. This is our broadband follow-up. And to argue against quark collapse supernovae, the easiest way to do this is to basically note that quark collapse supernovae, you start very hot and dense, but then as you expand, you cool. So then if you look at your UV to UV color or UV to U-band color, quark collapse supernovae shown in the typical ones, shown in red and green, actually become more red as they evolve. But Assassin 14AE stays extremely blue, even at late time, even after the luminosity plummets. So it's either some weird AGN accretion, some unusual supernova, which we only see in the very centers of galaxies and nowhere else, or it's a tidal disruption event. And I would argue that all three of these are extremely interesting stories, and they should be further investigated. And this is just our second TDE, which I'll basically skip through for the sake of time. So now, are there any questions on TDEs before I move on to more common AGN flares?
I just saw that spectrum figure again.
Which one? This one?
Yes. Okay.
Preliminary.
It is
the time. Yes. The reason you came to this talk. All right, so it's hard to have any AGN talk without showing this figure at least once, so I'll show it twice. And this is the unification model of AGN. And this is basically a story that's told to tell the difference between type 1 Seyferts and type 2 Seyferts and say that they come from the same parent population. So type 1 Seyfert shows this broad H-beta, H-alpha emission, where type 2 Seyfert only shows a narrow emission, which is seen in a type 1 Seyfert. Type 1s often, but not always, also see a blue rise going into the UV. And what this picture says is that the difference between these two sources is just your viewing angle. Type 1 Seyfert, you can see the broad line region near the black hole. But on a type 2 Seyfert, your view of this material is obscured by some obscuring medium whose nature is uncertain. A challenge or a complication to this picture that AGN have actually been seen to change their type. There are four which have seen their broadline components completely vanish. There are five which have seen their broadlines appear. And Markarian 590 is my favorite object, and it's actually seen to do both. So in the 70s, it was basically a Seyfert 1.8, did not have any broad H-beta emission. Through the 80s and 90s, broad emission appears, and then through the 2000s to present day, and then goes away again. But what's interesting, at least the connection to Assassin, is that Assassin's actually been able to find another one of these change-and-look AGN. And I know you're all wondering, how does a photometric survey with huge pixels discover a spectroscopic change of an AGN? It's an interesting story, which I'll kind of lead you through right now. And that's that Assassin triggered on an increase in flux from the inner regions of NGC 2617. We thought it could be a supernova in the inner region, so we got a follow-up image from the MDM 2.4 meter shown in the lower left. The archival SDSS is shown in the upper right, and we subtracted two. Yes, Assassin did see an increase in flux from the inner regions of this galaxy, and it's extremely well associated with the core. At this point, we said it's probably AGN activity, but we wanted to get a follow-up spectra to see if it was a supernova. This is early on in the Assassin survey. The follow-up spectra is shown in red here, which is clearly a type 1 Seyfert. But when you look at archival data, you see in 2003 and in 1999, this was a 1.8 Seyfert. So this is a very drastic spectroscopic change. At this point, we just announced an ATEL, and we thought we would be done with this source. But we had many different groups writing into us saying, oh, do you guys want near IR data? Oh, do you guys want optical data? Do you want us to submit a SWIFT TRO proposal, which never happens in supernovae? So then at this point, I figured there's enough interest that I'll get over my anti-AGN bias and actually write a paper and see where this leads. So here I show you a couple of representative X-ray and UV light curves from SWIFT. We have optical light curve and a near IR light curve. The Assassin original detection is back here, a few days after observing this with SWIFT, we saw that this source went through a huge X-ray, another large outburst, all the way from the X-ray down to the near IR. And at this point, the AGN is brighter in the X-rays by over a factor of 10 brighter than it was in quiescent phase, which is quite a large change for AGN. So I was sitting around trying to piece together this story. We have an Assassin flare, we have a change in spectral type, and we also have this larger flare later on, and what's going on. And the first thing that I noticed is if you just look by eye at these outbursts, if you look at the beginning of these outbursts, you see the X-ray. So it's here, it's basically right here. So, but it didn't fade again. It stayed basically constant. So Assassin flared, saw it here, and then it had an even larger flare on top of that. So if you look at the beginning of the flare in the X-ray, and you go to the UV, optical, and near IR, you can actually see this trend that the flare started in the X-ray and went to longer wavelengths. So AGN have been known to vary at basically all wavelengths for a very long time, but the drivers of this variability are uncertain. And people have looked for correlations before the study between the X-rays and longer wavelengths, and there have been some results, but nothing that you could see by eye, nothing that was nearly this convincing. And if you do a cross-correlation analysis, you can pull out exactly what your eye sees, that the UV is lagging behind the X-rays, and then as you go to longer wavelengths, the lag increases throughout time. What could be driving this variability? The first thing that you might come to your mind is you would say AGN are accretion powered, so you have an additional accretion which is causing this flare. But that would, naively at least, you would dump that material on the outside of your disk. Then this perturbation would propagate inward. And this would basically show you from long wavelengths to short wavelengths, which we don't see in this object. But what we do see in this object is we see the X-rays first. So if we just come up with a toy model where we put the observed X-rays as a point source above the disk, you have the X-rays then emit in 4 pi. Where they hit the disk, they then thermalize. You have a steady state accretion, but then now you have additional flux where the X-rays are hitting in your disk. And then they raise their temperature and re-emit. And this will naturally reproduce this inside-out variation that we see in our light curves.
What about if you're doing what Jordi and I said black holes do? And what if you're catching a star with the accretion disk and grinding it up? And that happens at small VDI. Because that's where your density of drive is highest, because that's where your density is highest.
So where are your X-rays coming from here, then?
So you're still getting, your X-rays are just coming from your, you know, super hot accretion disk. You basically are just increasing your accretion rate sort of instantaneously with the grinding up of that star.
So I know for quasars, at least, if you look at where X-ray emission generally comes from, through microlensing, it's very well associated with the black hole. It's inside the innermost stable orbit.
Right.
So I guess I have to think more about this.
You're pushing that material in, basically. You kind of get a burp in the accretion region.
Wouldn't it start further out in that case?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it start further out?
the mass that's being created, and then it would funnel in.
I mean, it depends on where you're. It depends on where you're disrupting.
Okay. Well, wherever it's disrupted, will be disrupted, and then it will funnel in.
Right, but you get it disrupted really close in because I mean, it depends on the mass, the density profile of the disk, of the accretion disk, which I don't really know. But you're typically tearing stuff up close because just that's where your drag is high.
Let's just see how well this model fits.
Right.
What's the cost of the X-ray?
So we don't. I would say that's very uncertain.
Because in the X-rays, there is this, like, you know, also a correlation between time, so the variability, and the soft and hard X-rays. That's the X-ray also has perturbations outside of it for the vision X-ray. I don't remember the whole story, but it's not interesting. I forget what is the actual cause of this. You need something to elicit pulse outside the disk. Is that?
To my knowledge, is unknown. I definitely don't know an answer. I think I've seen multiple mechanisms for X-ray emission in AGN, and I'm uncertain which one to believe. But if you just believe this simple toy model, which is certainly wrong in details, at least in some respect, then you get the following black line. So you just take the observed X-ray light curves, and you just you basically fit for the distance above the disk that the X-rays must be coming from. Then you just naturally produce these black lines. So we can fit the UV and the optical extremely well. The near IR, we have issues, but I think this is probably just coming from reprocessing of shorter wavelengths by some dust.
Put a source in the corona, essentially, and allowed it to...
So a point source, so it's like a lamppost model, so it's basically just a point source, a distance above the black hole, and that's all we did.
What's a best fit distance?
So there is one weird thing with our model, which you can see here.
Doesn't look too good then.
Really? I would definitely welcome any further work in this case. So the weird thing is that we basically have to add a two-day lag in by hand. And then on top of that, then you have this light travel time. The problem is that the UVs come from such a small region that you can't get this two-day delay. And I tried to go through and try to figure out where you could be getting a two-day delay from. I tried many different things, and I couldn't get anything better than this. So that is one that is probably the most unsavory aspect of this this simple toy model. But this was definitely put out there as a teaser to theorists to hopefully drive more study into this object. And we have more observational evidence for this object.
Could that two-day delay be that the source is 2 light days above the disk?
So the problem then is none of your fluxes work. So we tried to do that, and then basically once you're 2 days above, then you start to hit, there's two things. There's one, the delay that I showed, and the other thing is smoothing, right? So as you go to longer wavelengths, there's larger regions of your disk which are made at a certain wavelength, and that smooths out your light curve, and you can't reproduce the lag and the smoothing at the same time by moving the point source higher. The fits don't work out.
If you ignore the delay and for just the, if you ignore the two-day thing and just the delay across wavelengths, what distance is that?
If you ignore the delay, so you mean?
If it would have started at zero.
Yeah.
Well, then it would basically be 2 plus 3, so 2.3 light days above the disk, right? And you can just read it off of the cross-correlation plot.
What information is there in the slope of this?
So that information would be coming from what your temperature profile of your accretion disk is. That portion is consistent with what people expect. So it's still weird, and if you expected the complete story of NGC 2617, you're going to be disappointed with this talk, because I still haven't explained why we see this outburst and then why there's this change in spectroscopic type. And the toy model can definitely be used more work. To reduce some of this, we have started last year and finished a reverberation map, 3-month reverberation mapping campaign of this source, where we have daily spectra, X-ray, UV, and optical observations. And this is work from Michael Fajna, another grad student at Ohio State, which should be coming out later this year. And this will basically pin down the mass of the black hole and help constrain your models better. But this object has actually led and very much influenced the Assassin patrols, which I want to do. One of them is a patrol on AGN. So Assassin patrols are to release our data in an organized, focused, and useful way. These are the three main things that drive our decisions when we decide how to structure the CV patrol, or the patrols in general. We already have the CV patrol, which I'll show you extremely quickly. I'm running out of time. So this is our CV patrol. Oh, sorry.
Nice.
Nice. It's a nice big one. Okay, so this is our CV patrol. So the top figure here shows actually all active CV in the past week on the entire sky that are known. We basically have a table of the top 10 most active CV. If you click at the bottom, then you can see all of our active CVs, which you can click on any one of these that you want and get our current light curve. So this is the top one. So this one says it's typically around 17th magnitude and it has a 5.5 magnitude outburst. And so when you look in our data, you can actually see it. And if you want to look at the entire light curve, you can. And you see that, yes, there have been small outbursts on this object before, but nothing as large as that we're seeing now. And so this is what we want to expand to, not just CVs, but go on to AGN, blazars, quasars, M-dwarfs. And we're definitely open for any other patrols that the community would like.
Can you download the light curve here, or like?
So you will be able to. This is definitely an alpha. So there's many things that we're still improving. One of them is exactly how we do the photometry. So I don't want people downloading the light curve at this point and then be disappointed with the quality of the photometry.
How old is the photometry?
Sorry.
How old is the photometry?
At this point, I'm just doing aperture photometry on the individual images, and basically there's zero cutouts for data that we know bad, like if they're cloudy, etc. So that's to be determined still, how good the photometry will be. Now, one other thing that we're working on, and this goes to the useful, is that we are going into basically having our users go in and be able to select what types of objects they're interested in. So if you have a particular class you're interested in, or a particular object, declination, I can only observe things in the Northern Hemisphere. You select whatever criterion you want. I only want to see things that outburst by more than 4 magnitudes. And then our data will be downloaded, and once we actually see an outburst from an object that meets your criterion, you'll get an email less than 30 minutes after the data is taken saying, you might want to observe this object now, this meets all your criterion.
Essentially, you can set your own patrol.
You can,
through your data.
Yeah, so and then each separate section will have its own criterion, because different, like AGN, what people, but people who care about AGN and what people care about CVs, they're very different, and what they want may be different. And so it'll be targeted for each group inside the patrols. And this was all driven basically by NGC 2617, because what I really wanted to do was I wanted to see if this flare and then change the spectroscopic type is ubiquitous or it's just unique to this one object. So I want to basically monitor all bright AGN on the sky, and then when they flare, then we just go get a spectroscopic follow-up. But this exact data set and all the tools I have to develop to do this are useful for many other things, like studying AGN variability, which is not something I'm interested in, but I would love if other people are interested in as well. And finally, I'll talk about Assassin Mark 4 extremely quickly. I'll just remind you, Cassius is expanding in the next couple months. Then we'll be doing the entire sky. With future funding, one of our very long-term goals is to actually go to 4 sites and have 16 total cameras. And the reason we want to do this is because we want to be at different longitudes. Because as anyone who knows the weather on the East Coast this year in the winter knows, bad weather is very correlated with itself. So that was our typical cadence, which of last night, but this was actually earlier in March, where we basically had a week of this bad weather, and this kills transient surveys. So we'd like to have multiple sites in longitude. We have a variable star effort that's being led up by Andreas Jordan in the University of Catalica. Looking back at the original ACES survey, our namesake, all they were is a variability survey. If you just look at publications, there are over almost 210 refereed publications that use ACES data, and they mention ACES in their abstract. And 36 of them were from last year. And Assassin is basically the same as ACES, except that we have a faster cadence, we go deeper, and we have a much larger volume. So this says that this sort of study of all variable stars on the entire sky isn't very much in demand currently in the astronomical community. And finally, I just want to say we're making our data public, and our long-term goal is to make all of our data public in a useful way. So the real question that I want to leave you with is, what will you do with the Assassin data when we make our data public? So thank you.
So you said you were making your data public, but then I asked if you could download a live version of it, though.
Not yet. So we're I want to make our data public in a useful way. So I don't want people to download a light curve where I know there could be issues in it. That is the next step. So CV Patrol is very much in alpha, and actually, so Bianca Danilet's working on it, and actually my brother's also working on it as well. He's a computer scientist who works on Wall Street, and then we steal his time for free to do the coding behind the front end. And so they're working extremely hard on this. And once I'm more confident with the photometry, then absolutely I'll have just a link that you can download the data for particular CVs if you want.
What about going even more hardcore raw photometry,
just all the pixels?
So this would take money. We're open to the idea. I don't actually know how useful this would be to people.
Why would it actually take money to actually just have all your data accessible?
A lot of data.
It takes money and time.
It takes a lot. We have a lot of data.
Is it hosting?
Hosting, bandwidth, actually having somebody to stay in charge of this, right? I think very often in astronomy, we undervalue people who do technical things. And this would just take a lot of time, which...
I believe it takes time and money to release useful data. But I think that, you're hosting the pixel somewhere, and to have access to it, you just think it would crash too often. I just wonder when people, it's very clear to me why releasing useful data is expensive and takes time and
money. Oh, I see what you're saying.
But it's not as clear.
So you literally want less raw images.
Just raw images, just better beware.
I don't know. I don't think we actually talked about this internally. We might be open to it, but I don't think that anybody will. I don't think any science will actually come out of it, right? Because we've taken many years.
So that's a Sergei Kapasov. Just downloading all the pixels and all the dwarfs.
PanSTARRS is a little more unique.
DES.
I guess we could be open to this. We haven't really discussed it, but that's a good point.
About just your reference images.
That's another thing we could do. That's not so hard. But there's not much of a point to do this, because 3Pi very soon will be released in PanSTARRS. We have large pixels. So we go over 4Pi, but there's not much to be gained from just an image, right? If you just DSS, right, is better than Assassin, and that's been around for 30 years. So I guess it's we could do this, but I don't think it would be useful.
Just part of this conversation, when we talk about PTF data, that one of the big concerns is that to really make that useful, you need to release all of the code that is used to make cuts on your candidates, and then what the scanners and those were, and then the light curves and all these other things. And so there's a big complex framework that you also have to release, in principle you might have to release. So you mentioned that you get very good images in the center of galaxies, or you seem to do very well in the center of the galaxies. Is that subtraction pipeline available somewhere, on GitHub, or is it in a paper, or is it just some random guys? Is it just Chris's code?
I would say if you can read Chris's Perl, then you can basically read any language that you want. That is true. That is a good point. That is a much broader discussion, which we should definitely, as a community, not just for this particular project.
Yeah, this is becoming very important, particularly with CTF, which Todd and I are on the Community Science Advisory Committee, and this is something that's coming up as how often should these data releases be made, and what is actually useful. And there's clearly some middle ground between you know, just here's all the data, good luck. And here is all the code, the documentation, and the, you know, completely perfect photometry, which is a very, very high bar. It's not really fair to place that on people. Like, so I think it's just what is the right level where you can actually get it out in a reasonable time frame. So it is an ongoing discussion, but I think one that should be having in these types of talks.
Yeah, I know, I completely agree. So the community, if we really want to start to do these large data releases, where you release basically everything in a organized fashion, it takes money. You have to pay people to do this. And right now, Assassin isn't being paid by any national foundation. So where does the money come from when we're just keeping Assassin running at this point?
Would the amateurs be interested in that? Or is it just that they don't really ever get to the data analysis level required to kind of do that?
I don't think some amateurs are extremely good, but I would say most of the amateurs that I've interacted with don't even get to the data analysis level on their own data. They're just not interested in it, right? So, I mean, they can, and their own telescopes, they can do whatever they want. But for most of the amateurs that I've interacted with, I don't see them being particularly useful are interested in downloading Assassin data, especially because they don't look pretty in any way, right? Only M31 looks pretty in Assassin.
What's the cost of one of these four telescope stations?
The entire cost? So the lens is 10 grand, the CCD is 40 grand, and so times that by four, so that's 200,000 for the hardware, the optical hardware, and then I don't actually know, maybe I don't want to know the worth of the amount.
Probably 60 grand.
So, 200. It is Assassin's a bargain. Invest in it. So it's an, I would say we're definitely expanding as far as our collaboration is going, which is helping out. We're getting funding. Funding should be coming in from Chile and in China as well. Observing time definitely is coming in from both of these countries, and so there is other sources of funding, but not to run hardware at this point.
So just another science question: with your TDEs, were you able to get SWIFT on those? Could you see the?
Yeah, that's where our X-rays and our UV come from.
Oh, I didn't see the.
So I went really quick because we had such a good discussion that it took more time than I thought. Sorry. But yes, we did get SWIFT on it.
So they decay the right way?
That's a good question. So 14AE does not decay the right way. I've heard, I think, secondhand or a comment from you that you might think it might be contamination from the host galaxy. Is that right?
I don't know what you heard, but...
Yeah, it was true.
It's a possibility.
I think I agree that it's a possibility. Sorry. Here is.
There's definitely a lot of host galaxy contamination there, but for the UV, probably it's
minimal. Okay. So this is 14AE, and what's interesting is that actually for our second one, here, we actually have X-ray detection as well.
Yeah, this one's pretty bright in the X-ray.
Right? Yeah, it's extremely bright.
This one's very strange.
So there are many things that are very interesting about this object, none of which I can comment on.
I have a question about, you are putting all this data public and you want people that use the data, and so how are you doing with collaboration? I mean, are you trying to collaborate on object? You have your own collaboration to get follow-up, or because I had impression sometime that you already have your collaboration for follow-up, and Assassin is mainly doing follow-up inside that collaboration.
I would say, and all of most of our important papers, like NGC 2617, we basically an extremely open collaboration. I mean, just look at the author list. It took me like a full day just to collate the author list. So I would say that in general, Assassin is very open to collaboration. For certain objects where we know we have the data that needed to tell a story that we want to tell in a particular paper, then I would say there we're less open to collaboration just because it just adds more complex. And so one of the things that Assassin really tries to do is to get interesting science out quickly. So I would say that would probably be the main only hiccup between collaboration on almost any source. So for 14LP, for example, I'm collaborating very heavily with CSP, Carnegie Supernova Project, on this. And we have you know, optical light curves, but we know that the data photometry, the data quality from CSP is phenomenal. So that's actually going to help very much on the early term light curve. So generally, we do like to reach out. And if there's some other interesting source, which could be an assassin's data, and you want to write a paper, then if you just contact one of us, and it's and it doesn't take days of our time to actually to give you a good quality light curve, then we're open to that as well. So it's mostly open.
But it's not like certain people have like, this is my area, this is what I do, this is my area.
So while it's very loose, since we're so small, we can afford to be a little bit less strict than, say, like PTF, where it's very large. But typically how it goes is we have too many sources that we have too many interesting sources to, that we have people to write papers on. So the very interesting ones, then somebody would say, oh, I'm particularly interested in this source, out of paper. I saw 4TP, and I realized that we discovered it extremely early, and that out of all of Assassin, that's more of my expertise. So then I decided that I want to go forth and write this paper. So that's generally how it works. So it's not very strict at all.
It'll be interesting as you get better at releasing data. It'll be interesting if somebody else outside the core team finds something that you would have classified as very interesting, finds it first. I don't know. It'll be a good problem to have.
It would be. I mean, it's still going to happen. Like, Assassin's still going to be cited, right? Like, yeah. If the data came from, I mean, unless it's like some, an ethical like use of our data, then personally, I don't care. There's too much in Assassin to for. I'm more busy. I have more things to do than I possibly have time for. So.
All right. Well, let's thank Ben.